Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Mysteries in Time. I'm James Malacher with Angry Boomer Productions. With Mysteries in Time, I'm going to present mysteries, some fictionalized and some true crime, which have taken place in many different times and locations throughout history. If there's a story you would like to submit or a crime you would like me to investigate, please feel free to contact me at angryboomerjim@gmail.com. Once again, it is all one word and all lowercase letters, angryboomerjim@gmail.com. Getting back to this episode, it's a longer short story written by me and AI, especially with substantial AI assistance, titled Buried Deep in the Fog. The story mainly takes place in Port Angeles, Washington, and the surrounding areas during the final decade of the Cold War in 1980. It is narrated by Andrew in AI voice. Thank you, and enjoy.
Chapter 1. Fog on the Waterfront. Port Angeles, Washington, November 14, 1980. The fog rolled in thick off the Strait of Juan de Fuca, swallowing the docks and the seedy bars that lined the waterfront. You could hear the gulls squawk, but you couldn't see them. It was the kind of night that made secrets feel safe. Detective Eli Mercer leaned against the hood of his 72 Dodge Dart, collar up, cigarette lit, and eyes on the churning mist. Somewhere behind it was Pier 3, and on Pier 3 was the body of a man who hadn't planned to die tonight. The victim's name is Carl Stinson, Officer Riley said, pulling a notebook from his jacket. Local fisherman. Worked the crab boats. 47 years old. No wife. No kids. Eli nodded slowly. Who found him? A dockhand. A kid named Jesse Alvarez. He said he saw something in the water around 4 a.m. He thought it was a seal at first. A seal wouldn't have had a knife sticking out of its back, though. They walked to the edge of the pier. The body had already been pulled from the icy water and was stretched out under a tarp on the cold planks. Blood had mixed with salt water, turning the man's coat a rust-brown hue. Eli crouched and peeled the tarp back. Stinson's eyes were open. Wide open. Jesus, Riley muttered, turning away. Eli had seen worse. Not many, but worse. Any ID on him? Eli asked. A wallet in his jacket. But nothing seems to be missing. Which means this wasn't a robbery. Eli's voice was calm. Almost distant. You don't stab a man in the back and leave his cash unless it's personal. He looked past the body to the harbor, the boats bobbing silently in the dark. Let's talk to that dockhand. They found Jesse leaning against a shipping crate, hands jammed deep in the pockets of his flannel jacket, face pale under the dock lights. I didn't touch him, Jesse said right away. I swear, I just saw something weird floating by the pylons. I leaned over and saw the coat. That's when I called it in. Did you know Stinson? Eli asked. Jesse hesitated. Yeah, I mean, everyone down here knows everyone. He kept to himself. Did he have any enemies? Hell, everyone's got enemies. Especially Carl. Eli raised an eyebrow. What does that mean? He was fighting with someone the other day. Another fisherman. I think his name's Ronnie Talbot. I don't know what it was about, but it got loud. Eli looked at Riley. Get Talbot's address. I want to know what he was doing at 4 this morning. Riley nodded and walked off. Eli stayed a moment longer. The fog thickened again, swallowing the sound of the harbor. He had a gut feeling this wasn't just a drunken brawl gone wrong. This felt colder. Sharper. Somewhere out there, someone had planned this. And Eli Mercer wasn't going to sleep until he found out who and why. Chapter 2. Talbot's Alibi. The drive to Ronnie Talbot's house took them south through the quiet residential sprawl just off Lordson Boulevard. The town was still waking up, barely stirring under the gray weight of the sky. Port Angeles always felt like it had something to hide, especially in November. Talbot lived in a single-story house with peeling paint and a rusted truck parked half on the lawn. Riley knocked twice, hard. After a moment, the door opened. Ronnie Talbot looked like someone who hadn't slept or hadn't stopped drinking long enough to care. His eyes were bloodshot, and his flannel shirt was half-buttoned over a grease-stained tee. Detectives, Talbot said, rubbing the back of his neck. What's this about? Eli stepped forward. Carl Stinson was found dead this morning. Stabbed. In the harbor. Talbot's face didn't change much, but something in his jaw tightened. Yeah? That's a damn shame, he said slowly. But what's that got to do with me? You were seen arguing with him 2 days ago. Talbot scoffed. Everyone argues with Carl. Guy was a hothead. Thought he owned the whole damn dock. He started yelling at me because I was using his slip, said I was cutting in on his crabbing zone. It was nothing. Where were you between 3 and 5 this morning? At home. Alone. Talbot leaned against the doorframe. Look, I didn't kill the guy. He was a pain in the ass, but I'm not going to stab a man over a boat slip. Eli watched him for a moment, then nodded. Mind if we take a look around? Talbot opened the door wider with a shrug. Be my guest. Not like I've got a bloody knife in the sink. They didn't find much. A stack of overdue bills. Beer bottles. An ashtray full of half-smoked camels. Nothing that screamed murder. Just the slow unraveling of a man barely holding on. Back in the car, Riley tapped the dashboard. He could be lying. Maybe. But if he is, he's either real good at it, or he's not scared of us. Eli lit a cigarette, eyes fixed on the clouds rolling in over the Olympic foothills. Let's pull Stinson's dock records. I want to know what boats he worked with, who he owed money to, and if any of them suddenly stopped showing up. Riley nodded. You think it's about business? Eli exhaled smoke through his nose. I think it's always about money. Or love. And Carl Stinson doesn't strike me as a romantic. Chapter 3. The Ledger. The records office down at the marina smelled like old coffee and mildew. A ceiling fan clacked overhead as Eli flipped through dock permits and maintenance logs at a metal desk that hadn't been cleaned since Nixon left office. The clerk, Marlene, sat nearby reading a romance paperback, barely paying attention. Riley leaned against the file cabinet. Anything. Stinson's slip fees were overdue. Last payment was in August, Eli muttered. But that's not the interesting part. He held up a thick, grease-stained ledger. This was in his dock locker. Riley squinted. What is it? His catch logs. Not exactly. Eli opened it and pointed to the hand-scribbled entries. These are names. Dates. Dollar amounts. Some crossed out. Some with a check mark. Riley whistled. Looks like a loan book. Yeah, but he's not a bank. So who was paying him? And for what? Eli turned to the last page. One entry stood out. Circled in red ink. J. Mallory, November 13th, $1,500, final payment. That's yesterday, Riley said. You think this Mallory person was the last to see him alive? Maybe, Eli said, or the last to owe him something. They took the name back to the station, where the receptionist combed through the town registry. A hit came quick. Joanna Mallory, 31, address listed on North Cedar Street, not far from the paper mill. Riley raised an eyebrow. Isn't she the one who worked with the Harbor Commission? Used to, the receptionist said. She quit last spring. Word was, she had some kind of falling out with the board. Eli rubbed his temple. Let's pay her a visit. Joanna Mallory answered the door in a navy peacoat, her blonde hair tied back and her expression guarded. You're here about Carl, she said before they even introduced themselves. Mind if we come in? Eli asked. Then it came to Eli. He had briefly crossed paths with Joanna Mallory during his time with Naval Intelligence. He kept this thought to himself, though. It may be just a coincidence, but then again you never know. Her living room was neat, too neat. Not a thing out of place. The kind of order that comes from someone trying to forget chaos. I paid him off, she said, pouring coffee without asking if they wanted any. He said it'd be done once I gave him the money. What kind of arrangement did you have with him? Eli asked. She looked away. A mistake. Eli waited. I used to work for the commission, she finally said. I had access to certain permits. Carl paid me to push a few approvals through. Special dock access. Extra quotas. I was young, and he made it sound like a favor. By the time I realized how deep I was in, it was too late. Why did he need you to falsify permits? Riley asked. Joanna gave a short laugh. Because he was smuggling. Eli sat forward. Smuggling what? Electronics. Radios. Small engines. Sometimes liquor. Anything he could fit in a crab pot and haul off a private boat from Canada. He paid me to keep the paperwork clean. And now he's dead. Joanna's eyes were hard now. I gave him the last of the money yesterday. He said I was free, that he'd destroy the records. But he didn't. No, she said quietly. And now someone else knows what was in those ledgers. Eli and Riley exchanged a glance. This wasn't just about a murder anymore. This was about something bigger, an operation. One Carl Stinson had run for years, and someone out there was trying to bury it along with his body. Chapter 4. The Canadian Connection. The sun had started to break through the clouds by late afternoon, but it didn't bring any warmth, just a stark light that made Port Angeles look even more tired than usual. Eli and Riley sat in the squad car, parked just outside the Seafarer's Lounge, a narrow dive wedge between a bait shop and a pawn store on Railroad Avenue. "This place is where Stinson met most of his off-the-books contacts," Eli said, thumbing through a folder. "According to Joanna, he did his smuggling deals here. Kept it quiet, low profile. Mostly worked with a guy named Patrick Duval, Canadian. Used to run fishing tours out of Victoria. Now runs something else." "You think he came down here?" Riley asked. "I think if Carl was tied to anything coming across the water, Duval knew about it, or profited from it." Inside the Seafarers, the air was thick with stale beer and old sea stories. A few weathered regulars hunched over their drinks, barely looking up. The bartender, a gray-haired woman with a chipped tooth and a name tag that read Nancy, nodded at Eli like she recognized trouble when it walked in. "We're looking for someone who's been meeting with Carl Stinson," Eli said, flashing his badge. "Name's Patrick Duval." Nancy's hand froze halfway to the rag she was using to wipe the bar. She looked them over, then leaned in. "He hasn't been around since last week," she said. "Usually comes in twice a month, always after dark. Real polite. Paid in cash. But he was jumpy last time, like he knew something was coming." "Where'd he stay?" Riley asked. "Didn't," Nancy replied. "Boat. Tied up at a private mooring near Edie's Hook. Red trawler. Northlight." That was enough for Eli. By the time they reached the point and spotted the Northlight bobbing in its slip, the sun had dipped below the tree line. The trawler sat quiet. No lights. No engine hum. Just a gentle creak of rope and wood. Eli approached cautiously, hand on his holster. "Think he skipped town?" Riley asked. Eli shook his head. If he had, he would have taken the boat. They boarded the vessel. The cabin was small but well-maintained, except for the blood. It was dry now, pooled near the galley floor, staining the edges of a rope coiled too neatly in the corner. A broken bottle lay nearby, and a torn scrap of paper stuck to the cabinet. Eli pulled it free. It was part of a manifest. Faded ink, half illegible. But one line was still visible. "Next delivery, November 18th, same spot. PG. Riley frowned. "What's PG? "Prince George," Eli said. "Way up north. Industrial hub. Rail and logging routes. If this was a pipeline for black market goods, it could have stretched all the way to Alberta." They both stood in silence a moment. Stinson hadn't just been a small-time crook. He was part of something organized, something big enough to kill over. And now their only link to the supplier, Patrick Duval, was missing or dead. "Get forensics down here," Eli said, "and start digging into any recent customs seizures up north. Somebody's trying to keep this operation quiet, and we just kicked the hornet's nest." Chapter 5, The Man Behind the Curtain. It was just past midnight when the phone rang at the station. Riley picked it up on the second ring. Groggily, he answered. "Port Angeles PD here." A low voice crackled through the line. "Tell your detective to stop digging." Click. The line went dead. By the time Eli got to the station, Riley had already traced the call. "Payphone. Edge of town, near the old mill. Someone's watching us," Riley said, pacing. "Knew we were on to Duval before it even hit the papers. This is bigger than local smuggling." Eli nodded slowly. "And the initials PG might not be a place." He tossed a manila envelope on the desk. Inside, black and white surveillance photos from Customs and Border Protection, pulled from a file on a seized trawler up in Vancouver last month. Electronics. Military-grade radios. Contraband. And standing on the dock during the seizure, wearing a heavy coat and a smug grin, was a man labeled Philip Grant. Age, 46. A Canadian national and former RCMP, suspected in arms trafficking. Grant runs a front company out of Prince George. Moves goods through fishing routes, logging trucks, even charter planes. Quiet, efficient, dirty as hell, Eli said. Riley stared at the photo. You think he had Stinson killed? I think Stinson wanted out. Maybe he was skimming. Maybe he got sloppy. Either way, Grant doesn't leave loose ends. The room was silent for a moment, just the hum of fluorescent lights overhead. You think Duval was a loose end too? Riley asked. Eli didn't answer. Elsewhere at 2:17 a.m., a small cabin sat nestled in the woods just west of Joyce, its windows blacked out, its driveway empty. Inside, Patrick Duval's face was lit by the glow of a propane lamp. A bandage wrapped his side, soaked through with blood. He moved slowly, grimacing with every breath. Opposite him, a man in a long overcoat leaned against the wall, smoking a thin cigarette. "You weren't supposed to come ashore," the man said in a soft Canadian lilt. "You know the rules." Duval looked up, eyes desperate. Carl was going to talk. He kept a ledger, damn it. Names. Numbers. If the Americans find it. "They won't," the man said. "You burned it, right?" Duval hesitated. The silence stretched. A sharp click echoed through the cabin as the man flicked his lighter, closed, and stepped forward. "You made this messy, Patrick. Now I have to clean it up. Back in Port Angeles." Eli sat at his desk, staring at the photo of Philip Grant. A man like that didn't just cross the border without help. He needed contacts. Safe houses. A network. And Eli was starting to realize this murder investigation wasn't going to end with a confession in an interrogation room. It was going to end in the dark, with someone bleeding out in the woods. And they were running out of time to stop the next body from dropping. Chapter 6. 3 days earlier, Carl Stinson always woke before the town. The harbor was quiet then, still breathing off the dark water like it didn't yet know the weight of the day. He stood on the deck of his boat, the Darla May, staring out at the dull pink sky, a cigarette burning low between his fingers. He hadn't slept much. Not since Joanna had called. "They're asking questions, Carl. You said I was done. You said no one would know." He told her not to worry, that he had everything handled, that the books were going to be taken care of. But it was a lie. He hadn't destroyed them. He couldn't. Because those ledgers weren't just evidence. They were leverage. And leverage was the only reason he was still breathing. Inside the cabin, the leather-bound book sat wrapped in an old rag, tucked inside a bait locker. Every page a secret. Every name a potential threat. But one name haunted him now more than any other. P. Grant. The first time Carl had met Philip Grant, he'd thought the man looked like a schoolteacher. Neatly dressed. Clean hands. The kind of quiet that came with confidence. But there was something else, something cold behind the eyes. "You want in, Stinson?" Grant had said, back in 78, as they sat in a private booth at the Seafarer's Lounge. "Then understand what this is. This isn't petty theft. This isn't bootlegging. This is a business. And the punishment for betrayal is death." At the time, Carl had smiled. He needed the money. The crabbing business was dying, and his debts were growing teeth. But now? Now he wanted out. The feds were sniffing around the border. His cousin in Vancouver said two of Grant's other runners had disappeared. Just vanished. No calls. No bodies. Just gone. And Duval. Hell, Duval was cracking. Drinking too much. Talking too loud. That's why Carl had made copies of the ledger. One hidden under the floorboards of his boat. One with a friend in Sequim, just in case. Insurance. And tonight, he'd meet Duval for the final payment. Then he'd disappear. Maybe Juneau. Maybe even Anchorage. Somewhere quiet. Somewhere far. But when he got to the dock that night, the fog was already rolling in, thick and damp. Duval never showed. Instead, Carl heard footsteps. Then nothing. A moment of black. Then cold. Back to the present. Port Angeles. Eli slammed the locker door shut at the station. "He kept a second copy," he muttered. He had to. Carl Stinson was a lot of things, but he wasn't dumb. Riley looked up. "Second copy of the ledger?" Eli nodded. "If we find that copy, we'll know every name. Every payoff. Every shipment. And maybe, just maybe, we'll find a way to bring Grant down." Outside, the fog was rolling in again. Same as it had the night Carl died. Same as it always did, right before someone disappeared. Chapter 7. Beneath the boards, the Darla May sat tethered to the dock like a ghost. No one had touched it since Carl's body was found. Too much bad luck and bloodied boats. The harbor master had locked it down pending the investigation, but Eli had pulled rank, and now he stood in the center of the deck, listening to the water slap the hull. "You really think it's here?" Riley asked, flashlight beam dancing across the cabin walls. "I think Carl knew someone would come looking," Eli said. "And I think he planned for that." They moved carefully, tearing through drawers, storage bins, and paneling. Nothing. Just tackle, old maps, a rusted flask. The smell of salt and engine oil soaked into everything. Then Eli's boot hit something hollow beneath the floor mat. "Here." He knelt, peeling the mat back and revealing a hatch with two small screws. With a screwdriver from Carl's tool bench, he popped it open. Inside, wrapped in waxed canvas and tied with twine, was the second ledger. Riley exhaled sharply. Son of a bitch actually did it. Eli opened it slowly. This one was cleaner than the first. Tighter handwriting. Clearer notes. No crossed-out entries. It wasn't just a ledger, it was the ledger. Names of buyers. Routes. Dates. Product codes. Kickbacks. And most importantly, contacts on the U.S. side. Halfway through the book, one name caught Eli's eye. J. Mallory. Authorized permit for night docking, March 80. Payment, $750. And just beneath it, P. Grant. Demands full clean out by winter. Quote, burn it all if needed. Eli snapped the book shut. Get this to lockup, he said. No copies. No word. Not until we know who we can trust. Riley hesitated. You think someone in the department's dirty? I think this book gets someone killed if it leaks. Meanwhile, on Cedar Street, Joanna sat on her couch, the curtains drawn, a lit cigarette trembling between her fingers. She knew. Somehow, she knew the cops had found it. She felt it in her chest like a held breath. And worse, someone else might know too. Because an hour earlier, a small envelope had been slipped under her door. No return address. No stamp. Just a single strip of paper inside. They have the ledger. You're not safe. PG. Her hands started to shake. Grant had said he'd protect her. That he had people in the States. But that was before Carl died. Before things got out of control. Now she was just another name in a book. Back at the station, Eli placed the wrapped ledger into an evidence locker himself, turning the key twice before slipping it into his pocket. No one else would touch it. Whatever this thing is, he muttered. We just became a threat to it. And threats didn't last long in Port Angeles, not in 1980. Not when the fog started rolling in. Chapter 8. A Shadow at the Dock. It started with a name in the ledger. J. Weller, listed twice, with coded notes beside both entries. Dock Intel and Night Access. November 12th plus November 16th. Eli hadn't heard of Weller before. No badge number, no public record. Just a name and a pattern, always logged just before a shipment came through. Could be a dock worker, Riley said, flipping through the personnel records. Or a night guard. Or someone feeding Grant info, Eli said, grabbing his coat. Let's find out. 10:27 p.m., Port Angeles Harbor. They parked downwind and out of sight, hidden behind the tall stacks of crab traps near Pier C. A drizzle fell in sheets, catching the reflection of the sodium lights on the wet planks. Riley passed Eli a pair of binoculars. There, a figure emerged from a side gate near the freight lot, lean, hunched in a slicker, moving like he didn't want to be seen. He crossed to a service shed near the old Coastline shipping sign, used mostly for maintenance gear no one touched since the 70s. That's Weller, Riley confirmed. Used to work port security. Fired last spring for drinking on the job. But he still has the access codes. Eli narrowed his eyes. Then why is he walking like he's on shift? They watched Weller enter the shed. The light inside flicked on for just a moment. Then off. 5 minutes passed. 10. Then, another figure appeared. Not tall. Slim. Wearing a dark coat with the collar turned up. The two spoke in hushed tones. Fast, clipped. Something changed hands. A manila envelope, maybe. Then Weller pulled something from his jacket. A folded map, damp at the edges. Get the plate, Eli whispered as the second man turned and walked briskly toward a dark car idling nearby. Riley clicked a photo. Washington plates. Local. Too easy, Eli muttered. They waited until the car pulled away, taillights vanishing into the mist. Then, quietly, they approached the shed. Weller was gone. But inside, behind a loose panel in the back wall, they found a rolled-up blueprint of the Port Angeles Water Treatment Facility, marked with red pen. An inlet tunnel. A service road. And one word scribbled in the corner. November 18th, northbound. Back in the car. They're planning a move, Riley said. Tomorrow. Using the treatment plant as a route. Underground, maybe. Smuggling? Sabotage. Eli tapped the blueprint with his finger. Whatever it is, they're not sneaking in electronics anymore. Not through a place like this. Then what? Eli stared out at the harbor, at the long arms of cranes stretching into the fog like fingers searching for something they couldn't grasp. I think it's bigger than we thought. And I think we're running out of time. Chapter 9. The Tunnel Below. November 18th, the time was 1:42 a.m. and the location was the Port Angeles Water Treatment Facility. The night was dead quiet, save for the low whine of wind pushing against the fencing. A pair of crows flitted across the dark sky, startled by the crunch of boots on gravel. Eli and Riley moved fast but low, crouched beneath the shadow of the retaining wall. "This place should have been decommissioned last year," Riley whispered, checking his sidearm. Budget cuts kept it running with a skeleton crew. Two techs on nights. "That's it," Eli nodded, unfolding the blueprint they'd pulled from Weller's stash. "The service tunnel runs under the secondary holding tanks. If they're moving something, that's their route." He looked up at the hulking concrete structure ahead. An iron door stood partially ajar near the east maintenance wing. Not locked. Not even latched. "Like they're expecting someone," Riley said. They stepped inside, weapons drawn. Inside the tunnel, the air grew colder the deeper they went, thick with rust and rot. Pipes ran along the ceiling, sweating condensation. Water dripped from somewhere unseen. Their flashlights cast long shadows down the narrow corridor. About 50 feet in, Eli spotted it, a fresh tire track, dusty but defined, cutting through the grime. And beside it, a boot print. "Not theirs. We've got traffic," he muttered. They followed the tunnel's curve and reached a locked metal grate. Just beyond it, noise. Movement. Voices. They killed the flashlights and crouched low. Two men. One tall, wearing gloves. The other hunched, coughing. They were stacking crates near a large opening at the tunnel's end, where a pump system once drained into the Sound. "What is that?" Riley whispered. Eli's jaw tensed. "Ammo. Maybe radios. But that's not the important part." He pointed to a third figure stepping from the shadows. A woman. Hair tied back. Long coat. Familiar posture. Joanna Mallory. She was speaking sharply to the tall man. He handed her a clipboard, then walked away toward a waiting van on the far end of the tunnel. "She's not just a pawn," Riley said. "She's still working with them." Before Eli could answer, a voice called out from the shadows behind them. "Drop your weapons." Cold steel pressed against the back of Eli's neck. They turned slowly to find Weller standing there, shaking, gun drawn. "You should have stayed out of it," he said. "This wasn't your fight." "Put it down, Weller," Eli said calmly. "You're in over your head. I'm in deep enough to know you're about to get killed if you take one more step." From behind Weller, more footsteps echoed, fast, deliberate. "Back up, maybe worse." And down the tunnel, Joanna Mallory turned and saw them. Her face didn't change. No panic. No surprise. Just disappointment. Then she raised her hand and shouted one word. "Now." Chapter 10, Breakout in the Dark. Now. The moment the word left Joanna's mouth, the tunnel exploded into action. A bright flash, white phosphorus from a military flare, blinded Riley and Eli for a half second too long. Gunfire barked down the narrow passage. Concrete chipped and cracked. Sparks from ricochets lit the walls like lightning. Eli moved swiftly to the left and lunged at Weller, tackling him into the wall with a full-body shove. The man's pistol skittered across the wet floor. Riley grabbed it and fired two quick shots down the tunnel, cover fire. Enough to force the figures ahead to scramble for cover behind the crates. "She set us up," Riley hissed, yanking Eli to his feet. "Joanna's running this thing." "Not just running," Eli panted, dragging Weller by the collar. "She planned this. We were supposed to die down here." They bolted through a side corridor, one knot on the blueprint. Narrow and low, the walls slick with moisture and corrosion. No lights, just the thunder of boots behind them and the roar of water rushing somewhere nearby. "She's flooding it," Riley yelled. "Listen, the pumps." Joanna had triggered the pumps. They turned a corner, and the tunnel behind them filled with the sound of rushing water, then the metallic howl of pressure being released. A wall of water was coming. "Fast. Ladder," Eli pointed. Ahead, a maintenance hatch opened to a vertical shaft with rusted rungs leading up to street level. They climbed, Weller kicking wildly in protest below. "Let me go? You don't know who you're messing with." Eli slammed a boot into his chest. "We'll figure that out later." Riley reached the top and shoved open the hatch, just as the water roared below. The three of them burst into the open air, coughing and soaked, sprawled on the gravel behind the eastern filtration tanks. Sirens in the distance. Eli raised his head to the horizon. Lights. Flashlights. Multiple sets, moving toward the building fast. sheriff's backup? Riley asked, but Eli wasn't sure. The movement was too clean, too fast. I don't think that's the sheriff, he said quietly. I think that's them. Riley looked at him. Then we're still in it. Eli nodded, pulling Weller to his feet and dragging him toward the patrol car parked a block down. We get him into holding, he said, and then we smoke the rest of this out. No more hiding. No more chasing shadows. But in his gut, he knew something had changed. Joanna wasn't a scared accomplice anymore. She was the architect, and the next time they crossed paths, someone wasn't walking away. Chapter 11, Cracks in the Dam. It was November 18th at 4:21 a.m. in the Port Angeles Police Department, Interrogation Room B. The room smelled of bleach and old metal. One flickering fluorescent bulb buzzed overhead. Weller sat in a steel chair, handcuffed to the table, soaked to the bone, face bruised from the scuffle. Eli stood across from him, arms folded. Riley leaned against the far wall, silent, watching. You're lucky, Eli said, setting a tape recorder on the table with a click. You're not dead. She would have drowned you with the rest of us if you'd been 2 seconds slower. Weller didn't speak, just stared at the table like it might offer a way out. Eli leaned in. You used to work security at the port. Night shifts. Easy access. Good pay. Then Joanna comes along and offers you more to look the other way. Is that how it started? Still nothing. Eli reached into a folder and slid a photo across the table. One of the crates from the tunnel, half open. Inside, small arms, foreign military grade. Enough to start a war in the wrong hands. We're way past smuggling now, Weller, Eli said. This isn't just Canadian radios or whiskey off a trawler. This is weaponry. And you're sitting in a federal case. Weller finally blinked. Swallowed. I didn't move it, he muttered. I just opened doors. Who did move it? Weller shook his head. I don't know names. I swear. Joanna talked to them direct. The guy with the scar, he didn't speak much. Just nodded. Sometimes French. Sometimes not. She paid me through a P.O. box in Sequim. Riley stepped forward, voice quiet but firm. You said earlier, you don't know who you're messing with. Who were you talking about? Weller's jaw clenched. P.G., he said softly. He's the one she answers to. Philip Grant. Eli asked. Weller nodded. Yeah, but he's not just some smuggler. He used to be in something. Military, maybe. RCMP, maybe more. The kind of guy who has people disappear just to make a point. He paused, trembling. They're planning something. Not just moving guns. Something big. And it's not going to stay in Port Angeles. Eli exchanged a glance with Riley. What's the target? I don't know, Weller said. But Joanna kept mentioning the border. Said it would shift things. Like it was symbolic. Whatever's coming, it's about more than money. Riley leaned close. You want to walk out of this with a deal? You'd better start drawing us a map of that network. Names. Drop points. Locations. All of it. Weller hesitated. Then, slowly, he nodded. I'll talk. But you need to protect me. From all of them. Eli turned off the recorder. We'll protect you, he said. But only if you don't lie. Because one more lie, Eli thought, and Weller's not making it out of this town alive. Chapter 12, The Man in the Greenhouse. November 18th at 11:42 a.m., south of Port Angeles, Blacktail Ridge. Weller gave them a name, Lyndon Shaw, former botanist. No criminal record. Lived alone on the outskirts of town in a rundown farmhouse tucked behind a greenhouse operation no one had paid attention to in years. But according to Weller, Shaw had one job, distribution. He's not muscle, Weller had said. He's the guy who makes things disappear. Into crates of fertilizer, bags of feed, sometimes even soil shipments headed out through farm supply trucks. Doesn't ask questions. Doesn't talk. Eli and Riley pulled off the highway and followed a gravel road up a slope lined with alder and pine. At the top, weather-beaten gates chained loosely. And beyond them, the greenhouse. Glass panes missing. Ivy grown up through the steel frame, like veins. Inside, pale sunlight filtered through what was left of the roof, casting shadows across rows of empty trays and overturned pots. This place is abandoned, Riley muttered. No way someone's living here. Eli pointed to a set of tire tracks in the dirt, fresh. They moved in, inside the greenhouse. It was warmer than expected. The center of the structure was covered with canvas tarps, hiding a small working area that smelled faintly of oil, earth, and copper. In the corner, under a table of starter plants, was a crate, stamped with an agricultural seal and labeled export, Feed Stock, Canada. But when Riley peeled it open, it wasn't feed. It was a metal case filled with weapon parts, sealed in grease. Weller wasn't lying, Riley said. From behind them, a soft voice. I figured someone would come eventually. Eli spun, gun drawn. A man stood at the far end of the greenhouse, thin, late 60s, in a wide-brimmed hat and a worn wool jacket. He didn't raise his hands. He didn't run. Lyndon Shaw? Eli asked. The man nodded. You're under arrest. No, Shaw said. I don't think I am. Then he reached into his jacket, but not for a weapon. He pulled out a piece of folded paper and dropped it at Eli's feet. You're looking in the wrong direction, he said. Eli kicked the paper away from him, gun still leveled. Riley cuffed Shaw as Eli unfolded the page. It was a photocopy of a manifest. Destination, Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. Contents, electrical supplies. Inspection code, B4127. Authorized by J. Mallory. What the hell is this? Riley asked. Shaw just smiled. Insurance. And outside, in the tall grass beyond the greenhouse, Eli thought he saw movement. A figure. A silhouette. Watching. Then gone. Chapter 13, The Ghost Hanger. November 19th at 3:36 p.m. Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. Eli hadn't stepped onto military ground since his days working in naval intelligence, and it all came rushing back. The clipped speech, the iron gates, the sense that secrets here weren't whispered, they were buried. They'd pulled strings to get in, barely. Riley had a cousin in logistics, and Lyndon Shaw's manifest gave them just enough to bluff their way through the front gate. Officially, they were here for a routine inspection. Unofficially, they were hunting a phantom in a navy blue uniform. The base sprawled across the island like a fortress hidden in plain sight. Barracks, hangars, a few quiet patrols. Nothing overtly wrong. But Eli could feel it in the air. Something was off. They were led by a young officer, Lieutenant Hammond, who didn't ask many questions but kept glancing at the clipboard like it might shield him from whatever Eli was digging into. We flagged your manifest, Eli said, showing him the paper. B4127. It came through this station 2 weeks ago. Hammond nodded. It did. Electrical supplies. Civilian contractor. Never left the crate. Got moved to long-term storage. Hangar 12. Who signed for it? He hesitated. J. Mallory. Eli and Riley exchanged a look. Show us. Hangar 12 to 3:58 p.m. The hangar sat on the far edge of the airfield, isolated, quiet, partially fenced off for weather damage repairs. Inside, it was dark. Cooler. Dust motes floated in the shafts of fading light pouring through broken skylights. Hammond keyed the door. Rows of unmarked crates stretched along the far wall. Most untouched, but one stood slightly ajar. Riley popped the lid. Inside, circuit boards, coiled wiring, and beneath that, steel cylinders etched with numbers and Cyrillic markings. Eli exhaled slowly. This isn't electrical. No, Riley said. It's Russian. Hammond paled. Jesus. Riley yanked back the tarp on another crate, military-grade transponders. Not U.S. issue. This was never about smuggling across the border, Eli said. They're smuggling into U.S. military supply lines. Hammond turned, stepping away in shock. This is treason. Eli shook his head. No. It's infrastructure sabotage. These get wired in, hidden in critical equipment. Tracking devices. Kill switches. Maybe worse. Riley stepped back from the crates, his voice low. If they've gotten this deep into Whidbey, how many other bases? Eli's phone buzzed. A message from dispatch. Weller's gone. Cell empty. No signs of forced entry. Eli stared at it, then looked at Riley. They're cleaning house. Chapter 14, The Last Mile. November 19th at 6:09 p.m. En route to the Black Pine Motel, East Port Angeles. The sun was gone, dragged below the Olympic foothills in a smear of red. Eli drove like the devil was behind him, because he was starting to think maybe the devil was ahead. Weller was gone, vanished from a locked cell, no paper trail, no cameras. Just an open door and a guard who swore he stepped out for coffee and came back to an empty bunk. It was too clean, too fast. You think Joanna pulled him? Riley asked from the passenger seat, double-checking Weller's old contacts. Or Grant. Same coin, Eli muttered. Different faces. But there was a pattern. Weller never ran cold. He ran downhill. Toward comfort, toward habit, toward the Black Pine Motel, where he used to hole up between jobs when the docks got too hot. They screeched into the cracked parking lot just after 6. Room 5B, the curtains were drawn, a single lamp flickering behind the fabric like a signal flare. Eli drew his weapon. They moved fast, quiet. He knocked once. No answer. He knocked again. Weller, it's Eli. You want to live through the night? You open this door right now. Silence. Then, movement inside. Eli motioned. Riley took position to the left. Eli threw his weight into the door, splintering it open. Inside room, 5B. The air smelled of stale smoke and adrenaline. Weller sat in the corner, shaking, a revolver in one hand, a half-packed duffel bag on the bed. Put it down, Weller. You don't get it, he snapped. You don't understand who's coming for me. I do, Eli said calmly, stepping forward. But if you don't come with us, you won't see who they are. You'll be dead before you hit the floor. Weller looked at him, eyes wide and frantic. They've already crossed the border. They're inside installations. It's not just Port Angeles anymore. It's Seattle. It's Bellingham. It's here. Joanna gave the green light. I was the loose end. Then help us tie it off, Eli said. Tell us everything. Names, routes, endgame. You want protection? This is how you earn it. Riley stepped in, gun lowered. We can get you safe. But this is your last chance. Weller hesitated, then nodded. Eli moved to secure him when a crack echoed from outside. A shot. The window shattered. Blood sprayed. Weller collapsed. Eli hit the deck, dragging Riley with him as another round split the night. Sniper! Riley shouted. Eli peeked up just enough to see the rooftop across the street, barely illuminated. A shadow. Then gone. He pressed his fingers to Weller's neck. No pulse. Damn it, he muttered. Riley looked out the broken window. They're watching us. Every step. Eli stared into the street, heart pounding. They're not watching anymore, he said. They're hunting. Chapter 15. A Quiet Room in Sequim. November 19th at 7:34 p.m. Sequim, Washington, the Orchid House Inn. The room smelled faintly of lavender and bleach. Joanna sat at the small table by the window, reading a worn book of poems by candlelight, though her mind wasn't in the verses. The phone buzzed once, then fell silent. She didn't answer immediately. She turned the page, sipped her tea, then picked up the receiver. Go ahead, she said. A voice crackled on the line. Weller's finished. No heat. No trace. Distant shot. They're chasing a ghost. She nodded slowly. Good. The line clicked off. Joanna leaned back in her chair and stared at the rain trailing down the windowpane like fingers on glass. Below, the streetlights flickered on in sleepy succession. The town looked calm. Safe. Ordinary. It was a lie. She turned to the map pinned on the wall behind her bed. Red threads stretched between tacks, Port Angeles, Whidbey Island, Victoria, Tacoma, Vancouver. Circles marked airfields. Supply routes. Drop points. In the center, Seattle. She pulled a small wooden box from her suitcase and opened it carefully. Inside, a radio, a passport, and a photograph, faded at the edges. For people in fatigues. One of them was her. The man beside her wore a crooked grin and a Canadian naval officer's pin. Philip Grant. You always said we'd burn it all down, she whispered. And now we're almost there. A knock on the door. 3 sharp taps. She didn't flinch. She reached under the table, touched the pistol taped beneath, then answered. A boy, no older than 17, stood there. Nervous. Pale. Message from the port, he said, voice cracking. They moved the container up early. It's en route. Joanna nodded, handed him an envelope without a word, and shut the door. She poured another cup of tea and smiled. Chapter 16, Operation Glass Tide. November 20th at 2:11 a.m. Aboard the Mariette, 12 miles off the Washington coast. The Mariette wasn't on any manifest. She wasn't registered in U.S. waters. Her transponder read as a fishing vessel, but she hadn't seen a net in years. What she carried now was heavier than fish, more volatile than fuel. Philip Grant stood in the wheelhouse, watching the coast through night vision binoculars. His posture was calm, deliberate. He wore a heavy wool coat with brass buttons that no longer matched any country's uniform, and a silver watch that hadn't ticked since 1977. Behind him, a radio operator scribbled notes. We've crossed the threshold, the operator said quietly. Seattle port scanners swept clean. No alerts. civilian traffic heavy, as predicted. Grant didn't respond. He stared at the faint lights on shore. Civilization. Glass towers. Steel cranes. A world that thought it had buried him. They were wrong. "Begin preparations," he said finally. "We offload at Terminal 37 by 1400 hours. Security is prepaid. Port records will show a Canadian NGO delivery, medical supplies." He turned and opened a weatherproof case on the table beside him. Inside, a metal briefcase, foam padded. He unlocked it with a sequence of three codes and a thumbprint. The lid opened. Inside, nestled in velvet, were six matte black capsules, small, nondescript, and unmarked. About the size of a flashlight. Each housed a device designed to look like a transponder module, but built for a very different purpose. Each one carried a single encrypted charge. Electromagnetic destabilization. Enough to fry circuits within a 500-foot radius when placed in key nodes of urban infrastructure. Transformers. Data centers. Airport radars. Chaos by design. "The first blackout," Grant said, almost to himself, "will last 37 minutes. Just long enough." "Long enough for what?" the radio operator asked. Grant looked at him, eyes gleaming, for fear to find its way back into their bones. "You have your orders," he said. The operator nodded and moved below deck. Grant reached into his coat and removed a small photograph, faded and cracked. A younger version of himself, standing beside Joanna, somewhere in Eastern Europe. Before everything collapsed, before they decided to make the world collapse in return. Upon contemplating Joanna, Grant decided to have the vessel change course and head to Whidbey Island for a brief rendezvous with her, before continuing on to the harbor in Seattle. Chapter 17, The 13th Substation. November 20th at 8:42 a.m. Seattle, City Works Yard, South Industrial District. The rain came in steady sheets, tapping hard against the roof of the 72 Dodge Dart. Eli Whitaker sat behind the wheel, engine idling, steam fogging the windshield from the inside out. Riley Donovan leaned over the passenger seat with a folded city map stretched across his lap. "We got the access log," Riley said. "Pulled from a maintenance checkpoint near Harbor Island. Someone signed in under the name Jay Mallory." Eli exhaled. "Joanna. Like me, she was involved with the Navy Intel back in 73. She knew the utility grid, even then." Riley tapped the map with a pencil. "This substation, number 13. It controls a third of downtown. Power, comms, the switching relay to the port. She wouldn't need a bomb. Just a surge. And one blackout in the wrong place," Eli said, "and the whole system chokes." They pulled out of the yard and headed south, down rain-slicked roads that gleamed like oil. The city was waking up slow. Radios were filled with static and Springsteen. Power lines jittered in the wind. Substation 13 was an unmarked brick block set back behind a chain-link fence and a sign that read "City Maintenance. Authorized personnel only." Eli picked the lock fast. Riley watched the street. Inside, the hum of machinery echoed like a nervous heartbeat. They found it near the breaker panel, a small metal case, tucked just beneath the main junction box. Not big, not loud, just wrong. Riley ran a gloved hand along the seal. Custom job. Pressure switch. Could fry the entire junction if it trips. "Can you disarm it?" "No," Riley straightened. "But I can pull the substation offline." Eli nodded. "Do it." Riley opened the panel and worked fast, just copper, wires, sweat, and silence. Then a pop, a click, and the lights flickered once. Outside, nothing changed. Seattle was still standing. But Eli knew this was only one thread in a much bigger snare. And Joanna was already miles ahead. Chapter 18, Across the Sound. November 20th at 10:18 a.m. Puget Sound, aboard the Archer, OSS field launch. The Archer was a sleek, black-hulled patrol boat, a relic from post-war naval intelligence days, stripped of insignia and rigged for silence. Eli stood near the bow, coat pulled tight, binoculars raised. The sound was gray and cold, waves slapping soft against steel. Mist hung low over the water like a drawn curtain. Riley stood beside him, the radio headset pressed to one ear, the other scanning the horizon. "She was spotted boarding a mail carrier out of Port Townsend," Riley said. "A twin prop, low-speed ferry used mostly for supplies and the occasional naval contractor." "Destination?" "Whidbey Island." Eli looked west. Somewhere out there was Joanna, changing names, clothes, and loyalties with the ease of a ghost. But Whidbey wasn't a place you ran to without reason. It was Navy, top to bottom. And behind all the base housing and radar dishes, there were bunkers. Sublevels. Cold War secrets stacked like crates in the dark. "She's not hiding," Eli said. "She's activating something." Riley glanced at the instrument panel. "She has a 2-hour lead. If she plants the failsafe before we land, she won't." He adjusted his coat, opened the map case on the dash. The coastline of Whidbey was inked in red. Fort Casey, Coopville, the South Airstrip. "She's headed for the old submarine cable terminal," Eli said. "The one the Navy abandoned in 76. She'd know it still has power, and no one watches it anymore." The Archer cut faster through the sound. Behind them, Seattle receded into haze. Ahead, Whidbey emerged, cold, forested, and quiet as a held breath. The radio crackled suddenly. A voice, encrypted, coded, East Coast accent. "Archer, be advised. Naval intel confirms power flux near the Casey Bluffs. Repeat, anomalous activity. Possible compromised relay." Eli grabbed the mic. "We're en route. Tell them not to touch it. We'll go in dark." He turned to Riley. "No backup. No signals. Just us." Riley smirked, loading his revolver. "Cold War rules, huh?" "Yeah." Eli chambered around. "And she plays them better than anyone." The boat turned toward the coast. The mist swallowed them whole. Chapter 19, Dead Shore. November 20th at 11:03 a.m. Whidbey Island, near the decommissioned relay station. The Archer slowed without lights. It nestled into a driftwood-strewn inlet where the forest clawed right down to the rocky shore. The tide lapped against the hull like a whisper. Eli jumped down into the shallows with a duffel over one shoulder, boots crunching into wet stones. Riley followed, flashlight off, pistol drawn. No birds. No wind. Just fog thick enough to hold a secret. "Station's half a mile inland," Riley whispered. "Old Navy relay, powered by independent generator. No oversight since 76. Grant never would have made it here without help," Eli said. "This is Joanna's staging ground." They moved up the narrow trail, framed by evergreens and moss-coated branches. The road to the station was overgrown, but Eli remembered the layout. He'd trained here once. Communications war games. Back when everything still felt like it mattered. The structure came into view like a bunker resurrected. Concrete walls, rusted antenna mast, and a fence perimeter strung with old, useless cable. The front gate hung loose on one hinge. No lights, but a faint, rhythmic clicking came from inside, like tape reels rolling. "Someone's home," Riley murmured. They cut the fence low and crawled through. Eli led them to the side door, once sealed with a keypad long out of service. It had been pried open, neatly. Someone who knew how to handle classified facilities. Joanna. Inside, the air smelled like ozone and dust. The walls still bore the peeling signs of naval secrecy. "Authorized personnel only, radiation hazard, NOFRN. They reached the comms room. Joanna had been here. A reel-to-reel transmitter hummed softly in the corner, playing back dead air. A duffel sat open, full of schematics, wires, and three-burner notebooks, all in Joanna's handwriting. "Chemical triggers. Signal disruption patterns. Time switch relays. She'd left it behind on purpose." "Where is she?" Riley whispered. Eli scanned the room. In the corner was Philip Grant's body slumped over. As Eli walked closer, he noticed Philip Grant had been shot once in the heart. It was the clean shot of a trained assassin. He had seen a few hits like this during his time working undercover in naval intelligence. Was this the work of Joanna? He thought. As he continued scanning the room for any trace of Joanna, then he saw it. A note tacked to the chalkboard. "You're close, but you're late. Jay?" Eli stared at the message, heart sinking. "She was never going to detonate from here," he said. "This was the Echo. The real failsafe. She's taking it somewhere else." Riley looked at him. "Where?" Eli's jaw clenched. "Where the ripple hits first. Not Seattle. Not Whidbey." He looked north. "Victoria." Chapter 20, Quiet Crossing. November 20th at 11:55 a.m. On board the MV Coho, en route to Victoria, British Columbia. Joanna sat in the back corner of the passenger deck, wrapped in a gray trench coat, sunglasses despite the fog. The ferry's engines thrummed below as it pushed across the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Outside, the water was steel. Inside, the silence was sharp. There were only 9 passengers on this crossing, weekday, off-season. No chatter. No questions. Her forged papers were folded into a leather wallet under her coat. British passport, dual entry visa, birth certificate tied to an expired identity in Surrey. The customs man in Port Angeles hadn't looked twice. The small briefcase by her side was locked and dull. Not military. Not flashy. But inside, it carried the final part of the plan. A portable switch relay, pre-wired to trigger a shortwave code injection into a coastal radio tower once activated. The real failsafe. No dramatic blast. No screaming countdown. Just interference. A whisper slipped into the right frequency at the wrong time. It would look like a malfunction. A glitch. Until every emergency broadcast across the Pacific Northwest started playing the same loop. Evacuate. Contaminant detected. Do not use water. Military incoming. And fear would do the rest. Joanna looked out the window. Victoria's skyline emerged through the mist. Quiet. Clean. British in that old colonial way. She had contacts here. People who remembered the Cold War not as a concept, but as a career. She reached into her coat, pulled out a photo from 1977. It was of Grant and her. She folded the photo carefully, slipped it into her inner pocket, and tightened her scarf. This wasn't vengeance. It was balance. And if Eli caught up, he'd have to decide, stop her or understand her. The ferry let out a low horn as it neared the harbor. And Joanna Mallory smiled like someone who already knew the ending. Chapter 21, Borderline. November 20th at 12:42 p.m. Port Angeles, Washington, U.S. Customs Dock Office. The office smelled like stale coffee and wet wool. Eli leaned on the counter, jaw tight, coat dripping, eyes locked on the port official flipping through a pile of outdated passenger logs. You said she boarded the Coho this morning? The man asked, squinting. She used the name Mallory, Eli said. Maybe Mallory Grant. British passport, black case, 30-something, quiet. She wouldn't have drawn attention. The man grunted. Not my job to vet personalities. We barely check names. No computers yet. Just this. He held up a dog-eared manifest. She's on it. Row 8. Eli exhaled slowly. That meant she was already ashore. Riley walked in, coat unzipped, papers in hand. I pulled an old liaison badge. If we want to cross into Victoria with gear, we'll need to go through the embassy. It's either that, or we wait for the next civilian crossing. When's that? 3:30. Eli checked his watch. She's got a 3-hour lead. Riley didn't respond. He didn't need to. Eli stepped back from the counter and stared out at the sound. The fog was thinning. The faint wake of the Coho still traced the water. She's not just running, he said. She's placing something. Somewhere loud. Somewhere people listen. Broadcast stations? Riley asked. Victoria's got a coastal signal tower that links emergency comms down through Puget Sound. Military and civilian. She hijacks it. She doesn't have to blow anything up, Eli said. Just makes the system scream. He turned to the customs officer. Who do I talk to about commandeering a boat? The man laughed. Eli didn't. 1:08 p.m. Eli and Riley stood on the deck of a Canadian Coast Guard cutter. Borrowed, not stolen. With the help of an old naval contact Eli hadn't called in 10 years. They moved fast across the water, low and silent. Eli stared toward the fog-choked outline of Victoria. She's going to light the fuse, he said. Riley nodded. Then we put it out. Chapter 22, The Switch Room. November 20th at 1:22 p.m. Victoria, British Columbia, Coastal Signal Relay Station, Inner Harbor District. The facility looked like nothing. Just a squat concrete building near the docks, its facade weathered, its windows narrow and wired. Tourists walked past it every day, never guessing it still pulsed with the residual heartbeat of the Royal Navy's Cold War-era communications web. Joanna moved through it like she belonged. She'd been here before. Years ago, under a different name, shadowing a British radio technician who didn't realize he was giving her a map of the future. It hadn't changed. Not really. The same keypads, the same hum of sealed cables vibrating under the floor, and most importantly, the same unsecured manual patchboard in the sublevel. The failsafe wasn't about destruction. That was Grant's poison, his taste for spectacle. Joanna's method was control. She stepped into the broadcast hub, bypassed the security lock with a homemade passkey, and descended a narrow metal staircase. No cameras. No guards. Just static and machinery. In the center of the room sat a rotary override console with a frequency selector and six signal switches. It hadn't been touched since 1977. She opened her briefcase, removed a brass coupling device, military surplus, rewired for loop interference, and a spool of coated magnetic tape. She fed it into the console's auxiliary reader. If she activated it, the message would cascade through the emergency broadcast system, hijacking the first wave alerts from Port Angeles to Olympia. No bombs. Just panic. Slow-moving, self-sustaining. She adjusted the dials. The machine began to spin. Evacuate. Do not drink the water. Seek military assistance. This is not a drill. She didn't press play yet. Joanna looked up at the dusty overhead light. The glow flickered slightly. She was waiting. Because somewhere, just offshore, she knew Eli was coming. And part of her wanted to see him walk through that door. To see if he still believed she could be saved. Or if he'd finally accepted that she couldn't. Chapter 23, The Turning. August 6, 1976 at 9:37 p.m. Langley, Virginia, unmarked safe house, basement level. The house was soundproofed. Not metaphorically, literally. Layers of foam behind drywall, copper mesh to scramble frequencies, and lead in the floor. Joanna sat cross-legged on the concrete, a file open in her lap, lit only by a bare yellow lamp overhead. She was 30, sharp, controlled, loyal, but to what? Nobody could quite say. Across from her, Philip Grant, a Canadian security intelligence agent, poured whiskey into two short glasses. His sleeves were rolled to the elbow, his tie forgotten on the arm of a chair. There was dust on his shoes and blood on his cuff. He didn't explain it, and she didn't ask. "You're wasted here," he said, handing her a glass. "Langley sees you as an asset, whereas I see you as something far more, an architect, a master of plans, not merely a pawn on a global chessboard. What is he getting at?" Joanna thought. She had been with the CIA for a few years and was beginning to feel very disillusioned. How could Grant possibly know this? Had he been studying her for a while? Is he a double agent or just an agent gone rogue? But nonetheless, Joanna was intrigued and decided she would like to hear more. Joanna took the glass but didn't drink. "What are you building, Philip?" Grant was a master at manipulation. He smiled like someone rehearsing for Judgment Day. "Systems," he said. "Systems of response. Systems of fear. We've spent 30 years preparing for missiles and codes. But all it takes to paralyze a country is one lie, broadcast at the right frequency." He opened a folder, satellite images, hand-drawn maps, water treatment schematics, power grid overlays. "This is the blueprint. 13 substations. For broadcast loops. A brief period of total control." Joanna looked at him evenly. "And after? Doesn't matter. The panic is the product." He paused, met her eyes. "Do you want to stop being just a mere footnote in a mission file? Well, this is how." And in that basement, in that moment, she realized something. She didn't believe in Grant, but she believed in his clarity. She didn't say yes that night, but she didn't walk out, either. And that, as she would later tell herself, was the first betrayal. Not of her country, but of her own instinct to run. Chapter 24, The Final Frequency. November 20th, 1980, at 1:46 p.m. Victoria, British Columbia, Coastal Signal Relay Station, sublevel. The machine ticked. Joanna stood perfectly still, her fingertips hovering over the console's activation switch. The tape reel spun in silence, the message cued but not yet sent. "Evacuate. Do not drink the water. Seek military assistance. This is not a drill." She had heard it 100 times in testing. The words were neutral, mechanical, meant to sound authentic. That was the brilliance and the sickness of Grant's design. She now lived in it, and he had to die for it. Outside, the harbor was silent. A gull called once and then vanished into fog. Time moved differently down here, like it didn't belong to anyone anymore. Joanna reached into her coat and pulled out the photograph again, Grant and herself. She stared at it for a long time. They both had smiled for the camera, but only she had meant it. The rest was theater. The door behind her creaked faintly. Joanna didn't turn. She didn't flinch. "You're late," she said quietly. Eli's voice came low, steady. "You waited. I wanted to see if you'd still try to stop me," she said, not turning. "Or just understand." "I understand," Eli said. "But I'm still going to stop you." She finally turned. He was standing 10 feet away, soaked, pistol down but ready. Raleigh wasn't with him. That meant he trusted her not to shoot first. That, or he didn't care if she did. "You think pressing that button makes a point," he said. "But it only proves Grant was right." Joanna shook her head. "No, Grant wanted chaos. I want the illusion of it. Just long enough to make them listen." "To what?" "To the truth." Eli took a step closer. "Then say it. Don't broadcast it into terror. That's his voice, not yours." Joanna looked back at the console. Her finger hovered over the button. The reel clicked once more. Then, in a moment of newfound clarity, she pressed stop. The tape halted. The room went silent. Even though she was different from Grant, which she kept telling herself, deep down she knew she was better than Grant, whose only real goals were self-serving. She came to realize he was a master manipulator who had to be stopped, and she was the only one with the opportunity and means to do it. By stopping him, she proved to herself she was better than him, but also came to realize the chaos she was about to cause would only serve to further Grant's evil ambitions, not hers. This isn't who she truly is. She had nothing left to prove to Grant. She was now free of him. Joanna exhaled. Her hand dropped from the console. Eli stepped forward. He didn't speak. She looked at him, eyes tired, but not broken. "I'm done running," she said. He nodded, but they both knew that didn't mean the story was over. Not yet. Chapter 25, Coda and Gray. November 20th at 2:04 p.m. Victoria, British Columbia, Coastal Signal Relay Station, Perimeter. The building was surrounded now. Plainclothes RCMP officers, Canadian military liaisons, and a handful of American suits who hadn't shown a badge all day. Riley stood by the fence, arms folded, watching the sea of men with briefcases descend like sharks in coats. Inside, Joanna walked out under her own power, coat buttoned, hands unbound, until she reached the edge of the concrete path. Eli followed behind her, silent. Two Mounties approached. One read her rights under Canadian law. She listened, then nodded once. When they reached for her wrists, she didn't flinch. The cuffs clicked around bone like cold punctuation. Riley stepped forward. She flipped the kill switch. One of the American suits, tall and bone pale, turned. "Doesn't matter. Intense enough." Eli said nothing. Joanna didn't look back. She didn't need to. She was escorted to the waiting car. No sirens, no crowd, just the soft thump of a door closing behind her. The moment passed like fog. November 23, 1980, 9:13 a.m. Back in Port Angeles, Eli's office, downtown. Rain tapped the windows. A manila folder sat on Eli's desk. Inside were transcripts, redacted reports, and a summary. Operation Ripcord, declassified review pending. Joanna Mallory was in custody, awaiting extradition. But word was the Canadians weren't rushing. The trial might happen there, in the quiet. Eli poured himself a cup of coffee and stared out at the mist over the bay. Somewhere out there, the ghosts were settling. Port Angeles was still. Just the gulls, the fairy horns, the scent of salt and pine. Riley walked in, dropped a newspaper on the desk. "No panic in Victoria," the headline read. "False alarm contained before broadcast." Below it, "Sources say a former intelligence agent may have prevented a hoax that could have triggered regional evacuation drills across 3 states and 2 provinces. Riley sipped his own coffee. "You think she wanted to be stopped?" Eli watched the rain. "Yeah," he said. "I think deep down she did." Riley nodded slowly. "Hell of a way to ask." Eli leaned back in his chair. Somewhere across the water, the past was finally sinking. Epilogue, after the silence. April 12th. 1981 at 7:48 p.m., somewhere along the Olympic Peninsula. The house sat on a bluff, half swallowed by evergreens, the ocean stretching below like an unspoken secret. There was no sign on the road. No mailbox. Just a weathered gate, slightly ajar. Inside, a fire crackled. A radio played a soft jazz station out of Seattle, the static coming in waves. A woman sat at the table, sipping tea, hair tied back, eyes on the window. Older now, or maybe just lighter. Joanna Mallory was no longer in custody. The trial had never come. Diplomatic tension had swelled, then folded. Someone in Ottawa decided it was easier to make her vanish than to bring the rogue actions of a Canadian Security Intelligence Service agent and an American CIA agent to light in a public trial. That could get very messy and embarrassing for both countries. someone in Washington agreed. She'd been traded, paper-clipped into a folder marked inactive asset, monitored. A quiet exile. She lived simply now. No phone. No television. Just the sea, the fog, and sometimes, the faint memory of a man who had once walked into a room and told her she still had a choice.